Okay, it's 9:01. Why don't we begin? Welcome everyone to, I don't even know which term this is, but we've been doing this now for a few years. There's approximately, I think, 55 previous classes online, and we sort of go in order. In fact, this is the only time that we're continuing directly from last time because we were in the middle of discussing Ritzi Pesach Frank, and we're going to pick up right with that. I think eventually the website will be ordered, so you can go in a proper order, the direction which the class has started. I'll just say also today is May 11th, 2009. It's been a while since we were together. We had Pesach and the like, and many people emailed me things, many comments I could make, but if we commented on everything, we never get to the topic today. Although it seems that a lot of things people emailed me about are about the comments, so I'll spend just a few minutes the beginning of this class and the remaining classes, because I think a number of the comments that people sent me, or the questions, first of all, they relate to things we've done, and other people would find them valuable as well. First, just relevant to what we spoke about last semester about the women rabbis business, in today's Jerusalem Post, it's quite interesting, Norman Lamb was interviewed, and he was asked about ordination of women rabbis. And he said that his opposition was social, not religious. Change has to come to religion when feasible, but it should not be rushed. Women have just come into their own from an educational perspective. I would prefer not to have this innovation right now. It's simply too early. What will happen later? I'm not a prophet. So here you have one of the most influential rabbis in the United States saying what I've been saying for how many semesters, that there's no problem with women rabbis. It's just a matter of time, and you can't get more explicit than that. We spoke about the issue of parsonage, and one of our listeners, he's never live with us, but I think he's listened to every class, is Jeffrey Hochberg. He's an attorney in New York, and he wrote to me that I'm a little bit behind the times in my description of parsonage. As I described it, I mentioned that this is one of the problems with women not receiving any ordination because they cannot get this parsonage, which means, for those who don't know, if you work at a religious institution, your salary, the expenses on your house, and all the upkeep, rent, and the like, a telephone, that's deducted from the gross pay. So it's a big savings. I also mentioned that they can't be chaplains and the like, but that's something else, because the rule is, I'm reading it now, you need to receive an ecclesiastical endorsement from your religious organization. But Jeffrey Hochberg writes that in the last year, there have been changes. A pulpit rabbi, that's interesting. He says that he knows for a fact that some schools have been granting parsonage to female Limudei Kodesh teachers. I had been told from one school that they were afraid to do that because at least their lawyers had looked at the law and concluded that they couldn't do that. He also, for example, he says the Frisch School, that's a school in New Jersey, does it. He says, I'm 99% sure that Maya Note, that's a girls' school in New Jersey, does it. And he says, and this is dated in March of 2009, Ramaz has now instituted it, that is this year, after they got an opinion from Debevoy and Plimpton, a top New York law firm. And then he sent me, well, he sent me a few things. I can send it to Michael Broyd's article on may an Orthodox yeshiva day school or high school provide parsonage to women teaching Judaic studies. That's a recent article in which he argues that since we do not permit women to be ordained, therefore, since they're doing certain functions, they should be able to get it. This creates the problem that if Orthodox Jews start ordaining women, I don't know. But most interesting is Jeffrey Hochberg sent me a letter from Torah U'Masorah from this year stating that after consulting with their attorneys, they now are advising schools that since the woman is performing what the IRS calls sacerdotal functions, for example, davening with students, teaching religious studies, and providing students with religious counseling, they can give her parsonage, and they include a letter from Rabbi Avraham Levin from Chicago, who's one of the leaders of the Agudas Yisrael, and he agrees that parsonage for Limudei Kodesh women teachers is legal. One of the problems this raises is, though, that you have men who also teach at these schools and also perform these sacerdotal functions. So by all rights, they should also get parsonage, though. We'll see where that goes. Just two more minutes. We ended last class. I guess this is a good thing we can end. If we have time, I'll come back to some other interesting stuff about Kitnios and other things. One of the last things we spoke about was Ritzi Pesach Frank's notion of that Shechita, kashrus needs to be uniform, that you can't have a separation in communities. And I mentioned, and this is basically the end thing we spoke about, how that's always obviously been an issue in Jewish communities, and one way you push your own hashgacha up is by putting someone down. And I'm sure a number of you saw this play out before our eyes, before Pesach. And there's been lots of outrageous things that go on in the kashrus world, as you can imagine. But what was done to a tzaddik in Chicago, or Moshe Soloveitchik, not just a tzaddik, someone who we call a Baal Yisurin, one who suffered a terrible loss, if you know his personal with his child, for no reason whatsoever, to a few weeks before Pesach, 2 weeks, to let it be known that the Vod of Queens and Long Island doesn't regard him as reliable, and not even be able to provide any explanation, just to put this out there, was really kashrus infighting and scandal at its worst. And obviously what this means is that either I don't think he'll be gone next year, but they'll have to bring in one of the big hashgachas. I don't want to get into it, because it's really disgusting what happened. But if those who don't know about this, do a little web search, and you'll see a perfect example of what Ritzi Pesach Frank was so worried about in the area of kashrus. We ended by mentioning that we could spend weeks on his halachot, his various rulings, but I want to call attention to a few interesting things that are really, I'm not going to say necessarily unique, but give a flavor for the man. It's an enormous conflict of interest, not to mention the fact that, what does this mean, a national kashrus organization? Many people argue that local kashrus is better than national kashrus. If the OU makes a mistake, and they've made mistakes, no individual pays the price, but if I'm a local rav and I screw up, I pay the price personally, my reputation. So there's all sorts of conflicts. And what does this mean, national kashrus organizations? All these chassidish hashgachas, they're not national. And they're on all these shelves. I don't know what's going on there, what was behind this. And Rabbi Billet was the first one to stand up and say that this is an outrage, and he's from the Long Island Vod. So I don't know. But obviously there's a conflict of interest when you're on the local Vod. But that's always how you get hashgachas. You question someone else's hashgachas. You say it's not reliable, but if you bring me aboard. But I really don't know, because the people doing this, they don't stand to gain personally, I don't think. So I think maybe there's an issue of power here. That, you know, if you're a rabbi and you can declare that you shouldn't eat a certain product and people listen, that gives you a sense of power, and it's a power trip. Because what other justification is there for acting in this fashion? I don't think it's a question of a financial gain in this case, as it used to be when there was individual hashgachas. I don't know. Sure, they were on the... Yeah, sure. The whole thing, again, we no one... And the thing about this is that no one is ever accountable for these sorts of things. The local from newspaper in Long Island called for this rabbi to resign his position, but there's never any accountability for these things. I mean, you have to, and there's never any explanation, and I don't know what to say. It's just, it's really bad. I don't even know how you do tshuva for something like this. You take away a man's parnassa, because then he's gonna, and you destroy his reputation. I don't even know. It's incomprehensible to me how rabbis act this way. And then acknowledge that they don't really have any evidence. Okay. Let us go on. What are some of the more interesting rulings he's known for? Well, one of the most interesting is actually not even printed in any of his Sfarim. And this is where we ended last class. There was a case where a woman was separated from her husband during the Holocaust. She made it to Bnei Brak after the war. She remarried. She had children who were learning in Ponevezh. And then, lo and behold, her husband makes a trip to Israel, wanders into Bnei Brak, and sees his wife. Now the children are my mom's Arim. What do you do in a case like this, a terrible case? Well, they went to Ritzi Pesach Frank. There were other cases like this. I heard from Professor Shochetman, who knows from his grandfather, who was the Rav of Haifa, that there were other rabbis who did similar to Ritzi Pesach, but there have not been any responses written about this, probably for obvious reasons. Rav Tzvi Pesach relied on a response of the Maharsham, the great Rav Shalom Shvadron, who was a very important posek. Some of you who heard our talks on Rav Unterman might recall this, because Rav Unterman recommended doing the same thing, but I don't know if he did it practically. What the Maharsham called attention to a view in the Talmud that if you send a messenger to deliver a get, and you void the messenger, then the messenger gives the get. The woman thinks she's divorced. She remarries. You have serious problems here. Now, the Shulchan Aruch says that if you do that, that's fine. The get is voided. However, there is this view in the Talmud that if you void the get, the rabbis abolish the marriage, afkinu, from the beginning. In fact, they ask, they say, I think it's Rosh Hashanah Gamliel, they say, how can you do that? If the get is valid, mina Torah, what gives the rabbis the right to say it's a valid get? If the get's been voided, then they say, well, the rabbis have the authority to void a marriage from the beginning. So it's not that the get is voided, it's that you've never been married. And that's not an issue for Jews, because we don't have a concept of illegitimacy when you have children born out of wedlock. It gets more complicated, because if you look at the Mefarshim, they want to say it's not really a contradiction of the Shulchan Aruch, because there's this idea that if you void it in front of one person, then even the Shulchan Aruch would agree. We don't need to get into the details. All we need to know is that Rav Tzvi Pesach Frank did this halacha l'maisa. If you rely on this decision, the Marsham said that we can do this. Or actually, his response was a little different. He was in a case where it was too late, because this was much after the fact, and the woman hadn't done it, and she'd already had, I think the man had already remarried, and the woman had children, or maybe her husband died, I forget the details. But the Marsham said, had you asked me before, we could have done this. This is a solution for Mamzerus. That is, you send the get, and then you void it, and automatically it's void. The marriage is voided. We know Rav Tzvi Pesach Frank did this. How do we know this? Well, we have evidence, and for here I must thank Rav Tzvi Pesach Frank. I'm not Rav Tzvi Pesach Frank, Rav Aaron Rakefet, who sent me a letter from Rabbi Aaron Pachenik that he sent to Rabbi Rakefet, in which he testifies of hearing this from witnesses, that this is what Rav Tzvi Pesach Frank did. It was never made public, probably not to create controversy. There's always been rumors and whispers about rabbis who did this. If you recall, Rabbi Weinberg was very reluctant. He said that we can't do something like this in our day and age. And yet, we have Gedolim who did that. Rav Herzog didn't do that, Rabbi Kalman. Rav Herzog, in addition to other things that showed that the get was not necessarily a valid get, Rav Herzog said we could do this. If I'm not mistaken, the word he used was a sniff. You're thinking of an article by Rabbi Rakefet, I think you might have done that. Rabbi Bleich speaks about it. And Louis Rabinowitz had an article, the late Rabbi Louis Rabinowitz, in which he quotes Rav Herzog. And Rav Herzog raises the Marasham's proposal, but this is just one thing among many. Rav Unterman said to do it as the only way, and Rav Tzvi Pesach Frank did it as well. There's other solutions for Mamzerus today. I don't know if they're done in America. Rav Zalman Nechemia Goldberg writes that the woman should become a slave girl. What that means in modern times, I don't know. It's a legal fiction, but that's the way to free the Mamzer, at least with a woman. The article is Louis Rabinowitz. Yeah, and if you look, Rabbi Bleich in Contemporary Halachic Problems, Volume 1, responds to him. Kola wife, slave girl. I don't. That's what Zalman Nechemia and others discuss. What does it mean to be a shifcha, especially today when it's banned by secular law? But this was first discussed by the Minchas Yitzchak and the Chelkas Yoav. What does it mean to be a slave? It doesn't have any practical implications. By the way, that only helps for the woman, if the woman's a mamzeris, not the other way. What other things is Rav Tzvi Pesach known for? Well, we've spoken a number of times about the issue of gelatin in this class. Big machlokas. Rav Chaim Ozer Grzinski is well known for permitting all gelatin. He was the Gadol Hador, and Louis Ginsberg, great conservative leader, has a response to him in which he says that anyone who permits gelatin doesn't understand basic chemistry. So it's a machlokas, Louis Ginsberg and Rav Chaim Ozer. But the practice in America was to permit gelatin. Look at the old Hapardes. And then Rav Aaron Kuller and Moshe Feinstein forbid. And that becomes the practice in America of the Rabbanim, of the OU and the major Hashkachas. And that's really the way it's remained. There is a rabbi who lives now in Florida, I think in Deerfield Beach, Rabbi Sheinkopf, David Sheinkopf. His father was a great rav in Springfield, Massachusetts, or Moshe Don Sheinkopf. He was one of the permitters of gelatin. And Rabbi Sheinkopf is the one, if you remember on Pesach, the Joyva products. They have the big the marshmallows that they have liquid kitnios derivatives, so he says that these are fully in accord with the position of Ritzel Chanan. He has a book, which I forgot downstairs. I'll bring it maybe next class. I've showed it before, a book on gelatin and kitnios. And he's coming out, kitnios derivatives, and he's actually coming out with a new book. His shita is, an enlarged version, his shita is that gelatin from pig skin is not permitted, but gelatin from beef is permitted. And in the new book, he takes on Rav Avadya Yosef. He spoke to me at length about this, what he's going to write, because Rav Avadya has a tshuva permitting, Rabbi Novoseller, that's correct. Rav Avadya has a tshuva permitting all gelatin. Now, normally, this raises an interesting question, because according to Rabbi Sheinkopf, the only way that Rabbi Avadya can say this is because he doesn't understand how gelatin is produced. And I thought about this a lot, because let's say you hold of a Rav. Let's say you hold of Moshe Feinstein, and you think he's a great posek. And in one area, you think he's wrong. I mean, but you're just an average guy. You can still rely on Moshe, because who are you to say that his reading of the Talmud is wrong? However, what about a case where it's really Metzius? It's a factual case. And let's say Moshe, or let's say you were relying on Rav Avadya for something, gives a psak. And you know, though, that factually they're wrong. Can you still rely on them or not? I don't know. It's an interesting discussion. In any event, the first person in Eretz Yisrael to really come, you say no, you can't. I would assume not. Also, although Rabbi David Berger thinks differently. Yeah, thank you, Doug, for pointing it out. Yes, it's the Mishnah in Harayot that if you know that the Beis Din made a mistake, but that's usually understood to be referring to a Talmud Chacham. And it's not necessarily referring to Metzius, it's referring to halachic argumentation. But if it's I would agree with you that if it's a real Metzius, that they claim that. But what do you do in a case where a Rav Moshe Feinstein relies on a certain text, and we know that that text is a mistaken text? In that case, it's not so clear. Because you could say, well, you're not relying on, let's say, the Ramban, you're relying on Ramosha. And if Ramosha thought it was a good Svara, then perhaps you can rely on Ramosha. It gets a little complicated, but Sami Rosh is a good example. But I would agree with you that if it's true that Rav Avadya doesn't understand how it's produced, how you determine this, I don't know. In any event, the first person to give a psak in Eretz Yisrael was Rashi Pesach Frank, and the basis of his psak is that gelatin is totally changed the form, and therefore there's no such thing as treif gelatin. I agree with you, Bill. There's no such thing as treif gelatin, even pigskin gelatin, and this is the basis for the chief rabbinate. Every year, the marshmallows that they used to sell in the supermarket until 2 years ago they set it on kosher gelatin. They were given a supervision by a great rav, Rabbi Yitzhak Grossman. From Migdal Emek. He's the disco rabbi, the one who's done so much for Balei Tshuva and the like. Now they have the fish gelatin or something, and I even spoke to him about this, Rabbi Grossman. He came, a friend of mine is very involved in his organization, and he came to America for a simcha of his. But you have a situation now that, as far as I know, since the chief rabbinate permits all gelatin, most people in Israel eat gelatin, and in America they don't. And my friend who's a rabbi has on his website, he has a whole kashrus discussion there, and he says that if you're living in Israel, if you move to Israel, you can rely on this and eat gelatin, but if you're in America, the rabbanim in America don't rely. So my question always is, what do you do if you're flying to Israel on El Al, halfway through, then do you start eating it? I don't know. But it seems to be a real separation between America and Israel. Yes, sir. Rabbi Isaac Klein, in fact, I don't know his children or grandchildren, but someone told me that his grandchildren are Orthodox, and since they hold of their grandfather, therefore they take all of his heterim, I think on wine also. I don't know if that's true. But that's the issue. Rav Pesach Frank's tshuva permitting all gelatin is the basis for the Jerusalem rabbin, for the Israeli chief rabbin. Now you don't need him, because Rav Avad Yosef has permitted it, but for many years it was Rav Pesach Frank. Another important tshuva he got involved with, was Manhattan Erev. as I said, Kashrus is full of scandals and machlokas, but something which is just as controversial are Eruvin. And I'm not sure exactly why. Perhaps also power. Why is it that the machlokas, the disputes about Eruv, get so violent and vicious? And in other areas, if you hold one way, someone else holds another way, it's mostly gesunte hay. And yet, when he gets involved with Eruv, and I'm not talking necessarily about the rabbis, who I guess can debate it theoretically and still get along, but the hamonam sometimes, they cut down the Eruv, they do things like this, there's been violence over these things. My theory, you can tell me if you think I'm wrong, is take a place like Brooklyn. You have all these people, not liberal types, people with long beards and payas, they hold of the Eruv, and then you have, you know, the misnagdim who don't hold of it. So why do they get so angry and vicious and cut the Eruv? I think maybe it's an aspect of jealousy or of something like that. In other words, the people who don't hold of the Eruv, and they have good reason not to from their post-game, they see these other from people pushing baby carriages, the women are enjoying Shabbos, and they can't take. So that's why I think the arguments over Eruvin have always degenerated so much, because one person feels like he has to sacrifice, everyone else should have to sacrifice. But because this has always been an enormous sacrifice, rabbis have always been interested in making Eruvin. In Europe, it was standard to make Eruvin. You needed Eruvin simply because often the food was cooked up in one big one of these giant brick ovens, and you needed to be able to carry it back to your house. But there have been machokas about Eruvin going back even to medieval times. There was a rabbi in medieval times who was very reluctant to set up any Eruvin, and the Rush has a famous response. I'm telling him that he's going to put him in Chayram if he doesn't set up the Eruv. And because what does it mean if you don't believe in Eruvin, if you don't set it up? You're not moda on Eruvin. That means you have the status of a heretic because you don't accept something which the rabbis have established. I understand they see it as Mechal Shabbos before Hesia, but so what? There's lots of people Mechal Shabbos before Hesia. The Jews drive on Shabbos, so people eat food which they think is not kosher. But with an Eruv, they can't just live and let live. They have to get in the way and make sure, why can't they just say, okay, these people hold of a different Rav. It's not my Shita, it's their Shita. But it's the fact that they see these people on Shabbos doing something that they can't do. That's what I think it is. Now, Eruv is always a difficult thing to explain to the non-religious. I think it's, you know, what kind of nonsense is this? You know, you set up a string. Yeah, that's always been an issue about Eruvin. They're always reluctant to be motzi laws. Do you know the oldest Eruv, continuous Eruv, was in Amsterdam? And the latest incarnation of it is by Rabbi Rabag of the Triangle K, who was dying for many years in Amsterdam and is also now the chief rabbi of the Netherlands. That goes back all the way to the Chacham Tzvi. But Eruvin, to explain what an Eruv is always very, people find it difficult. But for me, I never really find it difficult, for the simple reason that basically all the carrying we do is only rabbinically prohibited. The only time it's prohibited, according to the Torah, is in Rosh Hashanah, a public thoroughfare, which, as we'll see, is really very difficult. Maybe Red Square or something like that is a public thoroughfare. But since it's only forbidden by the rabbis in order to prevent us to go to the public thoroughfare, therefore the rabbis can establish anything they want to. And the same rabbis who said it's forbidden to carry, let's say, just on our normal streets, they're the ones that said that if you set up this quasi-walls with strings, that's enough to keep in our minds that there's a Shabbos. So to me, that makes perfect sense. Let's see, David. Okay, well, you probably live in Flatbush or Borough Park then. I don't know. Now, the situation in America was that you had, obviously, Jews coming to America. Most of them at first were not that concerned about Eruvin, but there are people who were religious, and they had the same issues. Can you establish Eruvin in America, and how exactly do you establish it? Some of you might be surprised to know that the first Eruv in America is not New York. It's actually St. Louis. Before the 1897, if I'm not mistaken, the turn of the 20th century, there was a Rabbi Zacharia Rosenfeld. He wrote a sefer, Tikva Zacharia. There's a nice blogger. It's called Eruv Online, Blogspot. And he's already discussed it a great deal. There were two great rabbis, or controversial rabbis, in St. Louis. This Rabbi Rosenfeld, he comes to St. Louis, he does two things. He apostles the other rabbi's mikveh and sets up an Erev, and the other rabbi apostled his Erev, and it became a huge machlokas. A couple of years later, the first Erev was set up in the Lower East Side, which had pros and cons, that is, rabbis who supported, rabbis who didn't, and since then, there was always, the Erev in St. Louis didn't last long, but there was always an Erev in Manhattan. And finally, people got the idea that we can establish an Erev around the entire island. And if you're going to say, well, isn't this a Rishus HaRabim? It's not so clear. Rishus, what does it mean? There was Erev in Paris. You've had Erev in other big cities. You know, there's ideas that it has to be, the street has to go straight through, that the 600,000 people need to pass by, and who says it counts if they're passing in cars. There's all sorts of discussion. It's very complicated and huge arguments about this. One of the leaders of the movement in the 40s, 50s, to establish an Erev was Rabbi Menachem Kasher. And he had many great rabbis on his side, including Rav Henkin. Rav Moshe Feinstein opposed it. But in the early years, at least, he always said that the people who rely on it have upon who to rely. After all, Rav Henkin. Later, there were letters published, sent out by Agudas Rabbanim, which are very strong in opposition to the Erev, and Rav Moshe signs them. Either he changed his mind, or they just put his name to it, I don't know. But if you want to see all the discussion, you can see it in this book, Rav Menachem Kasher's Divrei Menachem. The second section is all about the Manhattan Erev, the history, etc. He includes here a letter by Rotzi Pesach Frank. Remember, you're talking the late 1950s, or it might have even been 1960 already. Rotzi Pesach Frank is the really Zakein Hador in terms of Psak. In 1960, he is the elder postsake in the world. Rav Moshe is a young man, relatively, compared to Rotzi Pesach. The Chazon Ish is no longer alive. Rav Herzog is no longer alive. Rotzi Pesach Frank is really the postsake Acharon. And he asked him about this. And because people always claim that forgeries and things like that, he actually includes, you can see it here maybe, a copy of Rav Tzvi Pesach's letter. And then he transcribes it so no one can accuse him of making it up. Rav Tzvi Pesach says that he's too old to get into the halachic disputes of it, but he wants to speak about the particulars of Manhattan, but he wants to speak about the concept of an Erev. And let me just give you a bit of a background, 2 minutes on this. There were people who were arguing that you shouldn't have an Erev because of what it'll lead to. It'll lead to maybe people playing ball on Shabbos, people will forget it's Shabbos, people will do things that aren't Shabbos-tic, etc., etc. In fact, today in London, I was told when I was there last summer that that's really the reason for the opposition of many, and I won't say Haredim, because the Haredim are in support of the Erev for the most part, but there's a Hasidic element there that opposes the Erev in North London, even after people came over from the Eda Haredit. And I was told by one of the rabbis there that the real concern is that this will lead to then women with babies and children going to the park and men and women mixing, that sort of thing. And they don't want that. So therefore, the Erev becomes a feminist issue. If you forbid the Erev, then the women with the children have to stay at home, and you don't have, it doesn't change their lifestyle. That's what he told me. They told him that the Erev will completely change the lifestyle of their communities. There have been other examples of this. There's a rabbi in Long Island whose father was a rav in Borough Park in the 40s. I believe it was the 40s. Meal Mart opened up, maybe it was early 50s, with takeout, the first kosher takeout. And the rabbis, the Rabbanim of Brooklyn, got together and put a ban on it because they were afraid that if you don't have the mother at home cooking the meals, this will mean a total upslugging, a total destruction of the traditional lifestyle of Shabbos and the like. And there was such an outcry by the women that they backed down from this chayrim, which people would have ignored anyway. I know that in Chicago, if I'm not mistaken, Chicago was the last place in which they forbid Empire chickens. You know, the rabbis wanted to give the butchers a living, and therefore they forbid these packaged chickens. We take all these things for granted. Can you, any of us, imagine living without packaged chickens, now packaged meats, without kosher takeout, things like that? But Let me take that back. There are plenty of people who don't live with kosher takeout. I was in Providence for Shabbos, and I stopped a firm guy on the street Friday afternoon, and I said, is there any kosher takeout? And he looked at me and said, where do you think you are? But for us in the big city, these things are important. Ratzit Pesach, then, goes into the idea that we don't have the authority to make our own gezeros. Rabbi Schwab wrote an article even about this in Washington Heights, that we shouldn't have an Erev for this reason, what it's going to lead to. Ratzit Pesach says, absolutely not. We do not make our own gezeros. We cannot say that we're not going to put up an Erev because of what might happen here, what might happen there. The Tzitzis Eliezer has a similar tshuva with regard to the Erev in London. Not to mention the fact that who's to say there's anything wrong with a father and son going out and throwing a ball around a little. You can determine, you know, what's Shabbistic and what's not. Ratzit Pesach develops, as I said, the idea that we don't make our own gezerot. Chazal gave us the concept of an Erev. You have plenty of Rishonim and Achronim that talk about how it's a chiyuv to have an Erev, to spare people from Shabbos violation. We cannot therefore decide, well, we're afraid of what it's going to lead to. We don't work that way. And I'll just add, some of these arguments against Erevin come very close to being denying the validity of Erevin, to violating this concept of being Moda Ala Erev. Because if the rabbis gave us the authority to have an Erev, then we can spare people from being violating Shabbos and the like. We don't have the authority, as Ratzit Pesach says, to make our own gezeros, that because of what's going to happen, we won't. If people want to do things that aren't Shabbistic, that doesn't mean that the rest of the community suffers because of that. Anyone who's been involved in the discussions of an Erev would want to see. Yes, in fact, Rabbi Adam Mintz has been doing a doctoral dissertation for many years. I don't know, if he's nearing completion, on the issue of Erevin in America. The New York Erev, there was an Erev, incidentally, early on in Toronto, since you're writing from Toronto, from Canada. Rabbi Graubert, the author of Chavalim B'Ne'imim, put up an Erev. The fact, though, you're talking sociology, the fact that when I was growing up in the early 1970s, you didn't have Erevin. And there was, other than Manhattan Erev, which many didn't hold by, there was no city in the country that had an Erev. What does that say about orthodoxy? Everyone pushed the baby carriage to Shul Shabbos. When I say everyone, I'm talking about lots of people. There were certain people who were medakdek, who had the key ties. But I still remember in front of the shul, the place was full of baby carriages. People carried keys. They weren't as medaktik in mitzvos. So as people with the day school education became firmer and more medaktik on Shabbos, that's why you needed an Erev. It's not an accident that you didn't need an Erev in the 30s, 40s, and 50s. The average person, that wasn't what he was very concerned with. An Erevin cost money, and people just weren't that concerned. So the rabbi and a few of the very religious people, they would have the key rings, the tie keys, and the rest of the people would do what they did. Well, it's funny why people don't use the Erev. I was in Boston when they set up the Erev, and I davened with the Boston Rebbe that Shabbos. They never had an Erev for all the years that Rav Soloveitchik was active, because he had a certain shita. It's a brisker shita based on the Rambam about Erevin. I never understood why that should be a reason not to have an Erev. Do you know that in Brisk they had an Erev? Even though the Rav of Brisk himself did not carry, they had an Erev in Chaslovich, where Rav Moshe Soloveitchik was Rav, and Rav Soloveitchik actually used to check the Erev. I don't know that the Rav ever expressed public agreement. They had the same issue in Chicago also. I don't know. Maybe the Rav did express disagreement. If he did, I'm not sure why, since, as I said, in Brisk itself, they had an Erev. But they did establish an Erev, and the Boston Rebbe got up and said that everyone has to use this Erev, because we can't have a situation where you have the Erevs only used by certain people. Then it becomes like a caste system. The people who are from don't use it, and the other people use it. That's not what we want. We want an Erev that everyone, because otherwise then you have certain people more religious than others. I know that Lubavitch as a Shita doesn't use it. I don't know why. I don't know if that falls into the issue of not being Moda al Erev. The reason why many people don't use it is simply because it's a machlokas. Many of these Erevin, the Chazon Ish famously stated as follows. I'll make believe I'm the Chazon Ish. I never saw a mikveh that was pasul, and I never saw an Erev that was kosher. In other words, everything you can do with mikvehs today are all chumras. To have a basic mikveh is very simple. You can even have it in a swimming pool, in many swimming pools. But we want to cover all the shitas. On the other hand, Erevin, any Erev you do, unless you're in a tiny little area, you're running into the opposition of great Rabbanim. No matter what Erev you do, you're deciding to go against great Gedolim. And there's all sorts of kulas that are relied upon. So when the Chazon Ish, he's obviously being facetious and saying this, because he himself used to check the B'nai Brak Erev, although they say he didn't hold himself, he didn't carry. He was being a little facetious by saying this. What he meant is that any Erev is problematic, and basically any mikvah is not problematic because it's only an issue of Chumrah. But when you deal with Erevin, it's not just you're relying on all sorts of kulas, whatever you do. So I can understand why people won't carry in an Erev. On the other hand, there's been a concept among many tzaddikim not to do this bitzina. That is, quietly, privately, not to carry. That's not to tell anyone else, though, just themselves. That's very different when people make these declarations. But again, I can understand that also. If a certain Rav holds that this is the halacha, he's obligated to tell his followers. What's unacceptable, obviously, is to cut the Erev down, or to mock the people who carry, or to regard them as Mechalei Shabbos, the signs they have in London. I mean, if you rely on a posek, you can rely on that posek. It's no different than anything else. Yes, the Rav said this many times, so I don't know when I lived in Boston, they said because the Rav had a different shita. I don't know if they out of kavod to the Rav, they didn't. I never understood that. Anyone from Boston, you can ask for my help finger. He'll know. Okay. Cutting down the air. Ah, thank you. I'll check that. Now, although Rav Tzvi Pesach was the Rav of Jerusalem, and he was the Rav for the entire community, they were always kanaim, always extremists who attacked him. That shouldn't surprise us. Both for political reasons as well as halachic reasons. He even had disputes with the Chazon Ish. Disputes about all sorts of matters, including the proper procedure when you take Trumos and Maestros, and Ritzi Yehuda Cook, in one of his letters, says we have to follow Ritzi Pesach. He's the Rav of Jerusalem. But in response to those who pointed out that the Chazon Ish disagreed with him in one special case on how he freed an aguna, Ritzi Pesach replied that if the Chazon Ish was sitting on a Beis Din, he wouldn't have had this opinion. And the same could be said for other opinions of his. This is quoted by Rav Avadya Yosef in his Sefer Chazon Avadya, one of the recent Chazon Avadyas, in which he has hesped in eulogies on a number of figures. He has a eulogy at Ritzi Pesach Frank. This ties in very well to what the Rav Avadya himself said about the Chazon Ish. What Rav Avadya quotes Ritzi Pesach as saying is that the Chazon Ish did not hold an official position. When you hold an official position, you have to be responsive for the wider community. If you're an individual, like the Chazon Ish had no official position, he can have any chumrah he wants, and the people who come to him are coming voluntarily. Yet, if you have to deal with a community that has to be bound by your decisions, you're going to approach matters differently. And Ritzi Pesach cited a story to support this. His grandfather is Rav Leibel Shapiro. Rav Leibel Shapiro was the Rav of Kovno. Not exactly a household name, but I'll tell you why he's famous. He's famous because he is, as far as I know, the first person ever to give a certain psak, and Rav Avadya quotes him because he's the only person other than Rav Avadya until modern times. Rav Leibel Shapiro said that it's usur to stand up for the reading of Aseres HaDibros. And this goes, and the first person to say this actually was the Rambam. The Rambam had a tshuva in which he said, "This you can't do this because this goes back already to the idea that we can't give any precedence to any one part of the Torah." Yet Klal Yisrael never accepted this opinion. In fact, it was unknown. It was an Arabic tshuva. I think a bit is quoted by the Maharam Alashkar, but no one knew about it, and it's the Minhag Yisrael for everyone to stand up for Kriyas HaTorah, even Az Yashir. Rav Leibel Shapiro, on his own, not even knowing about the Rambam, concluded that it was wrong and said in Kovno you shouldn't do it. Rav Avadya in his tshuva, all he cites is Rav Leibel Shapiro and the Rambam. The tshuva the Rambam, because there's no one else. So that's Ritzi Pesach's grandfather. Now, Rav Yisrael Salanter was living in Kovno, and Rav Leibel asked the community leaders to appoint Rav Yisrael Salanter to a rabbinic position. Because if he had to bear communal responsibility, he wouldn't be so quick to criticize the Rub's rulings, and he would understand what factor needed to be considered. Now, I think that's probably a misunderstanding of Rabbi Saul Salanter's personality. Rabbi Leibel saw this great Talmud Chacham, and he figured, you know what they say, keep your friends closer, enemies closer. Not to say that Yisrael is an enemy, but an opponent, perhaps. He worried that he'd be an opponent, so he wanted him in the Beis Din, so he'd be have responsibility. But Yisrael Salanter was not the sort of person to do that. In fact, he was the one who opposed the Beis Din when the Beis Din was too machmir on Yom Kippur during the cholera epidemic, and he stood up and made Kiddush himself. And then many people opposed, in the Beis Din opposed him for that. But this, all rabbis, and we have some rabbis listening, can attest, this is a common thing. The rabbi knows the inside story. He knows that there are certain competing interests here. He knows it's maybe a shas of the chak, and he has to give a decision. And you have these outsiders, sometimes Talmidei Chachamim, sometimes self-styled Talmidei Chachamim, that see this as a weakness of the rabbi. The rabbi is weak. He's liberal. And they use this to attack the Rav. And I've seen cases, there was a big case like this in Toronto, where Eshet Torah was attacked for having mixed seating service for Rosh Hashanah. And it turned out that Rav Shlomo Miller, who's the big Haredi Rav in Toronto, he's the one that gave them the heter. So anyone can criticize and attack, and that's Rav Leibel Shapiro. And this is exactly what Ritzi Pesach was saying, that when you have responsibility, you see things differently. Exactly. Another area that Ritzi Pesach disagreed with the Chazon Ish, probably the most significant area, was heter mechira. The perennial problem of what to do about selling the land. Ritzi Pesach had been in the land of Israel from early in the 20th century. He had seen the various sales, both what Rav Kook did and prior to Rav Kook, and he was a big supporter of the halachic validity of selling the land. The situation, the economic situation in those days was much worse than it is now. You can maybe make a case that today you shouldn't do it, although that's debatable, but certainly in those days, economically, it was almost impossible not to rely on heter mechira. And Ritzi Pesach wrote about this and defended it, and he has a haskama, an approbation, to a sefer by a Rav Elazar Kahanov. Elazar Kahanov is basically forgotten today, as far as I know. He was one of the rabbanim at Torah Vadas, a Ram at Torah Vadas, and he published a sefer called Toras HaShvis. I think it says something for the times that the Sefer appeared in the 50s, that you have someone at Torah Vadas writing in defense of the Heter Mechira. It wouldn't happen today, but in his Haskama to the Sefer, Ritzi Pesach writes that those who are strict in matters of Shemitah, and it's not just Heter Mechira, all sorts of matters of Shemitah, he says, quote, there are those among them whose intentions are l'shem shemayim, but the beginning of their examination of the halacha is under the influence of their desire to only be machmir. That is, they start by looking at it from a machmir position. They don't look at it objectively, to the extent that people can be objective. They assume immediately that it's got to be forbidden, and then begin arguing from there. You can see the sefer on HebrewBooks.org. The Chazon Ish was the leading opponent of the Heter Mechira, and Ritzi Pesach is a great proponent of it. In fact, in his discussion of the Heter Mechira, Ritzi Pesach Frank had an incredible chiddush, an incredible idea, which shook the Torah world. Because anytime something is said that's never been said before, it shakes people up, and this was an incredible chiddush. He said as follows, the land, as I'm sure many of you know, the land in the land of Israel doesn't belong to individuals. It's all rented out. Almost all of it belongs, certainly the farmland, belongs to the Keren Kayemet, now belongs to the Israeli government. Most land is actually owned by the government. So that means it's not individual property, it's communal property. It belongs to Kol Yisrael. And Ritzi Pesach says that there's no obligation in Shvit. There's no obligation in letting the land lie fallow in the sabbatical year for communal land. And how does he know this? Because the pasuk speaks of sadcha lo tizra, your field. And this refers to the field of an individual, not a community. I'm not sure if this, it appears that this is almost a drasha by Ritzi Pesach Frank himself. I shouldn't say that. It's not a drasha. It's trying to understand what the halacha is by looking at the pasuk. But that's not usually how we understand halacha. We don't look at the pasuk independently. You have cases of rabbanim who do that, but it's very unusual. And when Tzvi Pesach declared that the communal land had no obligation to lie fallow, based upon this, that shook the Torah world. Now, he developed it, if I'm not mistaken, in other ways as well, because what does it mean to be communal? After all, we all have an obligation to give tzedakah. But the shul doesn't have an obligation. The shul doesn't belong to anyone. We have an obligation to get rid of our chametz. Well, what about a shul? Let's say there's chametz in a shul. Does a shul have to get rid of the chametz from its closets? Okay, so they can't leave it out because people might eat it. They might see it and eat it. But if the shul puts its chametz in the closet, does a shul then have to get rid of it or have to sell it? After all, the shul's an entity. The shul's not an individual. There's no mitzvah on a shul. So if you leave the chametz in the shul, why can't we eat it after Pesach? The reason you can't eat chametz shavar on Pesach, it's a knas on individuals. So the whole concept of an entity and what the obligations are of an entity are not clear. So this is where Tzvi Pesach was working on. If the people of Israel, there's no one individual who can be said to be obligated in this, who says that anyone's obligated in it? It's quite fascinating, and we don't have time to go into it, but the whole concept of a corporation in halacha, corporation charging interest, corporation selling non-kosher, all these things. What's the role of a corporation? The responsibility of a corporation in injuries and all that. Who is the corporation? The stockholders? Fine, but a shul doesn't have stockholders, or a non-profit. So although the chiddush at first seems shocking, that you're going to say the state of Israel doesn't have to get rid of its Shemitah products, and they just like today they get rid of their chametz, when you think of it, it's more complicated than it appears at first glance. Rav Shaul Weingart, indeed. Thank you, CYL, who I don't know. Shaul Weingart, Tom and Mufak of Rabbi Yechiel Yaakov Weinberg, unfortunately is killed in a train accident in 1946 in Switzerland. He, to get smicha from the Berlin Rabbinical Seminary, which he did in the late 30s, you had to actually write 3 responsa. It would be very nice if in YU today, instead of just having a bechina on your adeya, they gave you a case and you had to show some originality. Shaul Weingart, in this response, and this is, as far as I know, the first treatment of the status of a corporation in Jewish law. It was published in a book, Yad Shaul, a memorial volume for him, edited by Rabbi Weinberg. And the Minchas Yitzchak even has a tshuva on which he quotes it and discusses it. So we should, Shaul Weingart's son is Avram Abba Weingart, involved in the Hezri Yeshiva in Israel. He's the one, for those who follow what I do, he's the one who was so opposed to me publishing the letters of the Sridi Yesh, because Avram Abba Weingart was the biggest student of Rabbi Yechiel Yaakov Weinberg after the war. Weinberg was his father figure. Rabbi Weinberg raised Avram Abba because he was orphaned at like age 2, orphaned of his father. He was the Talmud Mufak after the war, because there really weren't any other Talmudim. Rashal Weingart was a Talmud Mufak before the war. So thank you very much, CYL. Simcha, I've never heard that you don't need to be Tovel, Kalim, from Farberware, etc. It makes perfect sense. The Svara, the logic, makes perfect sense that if you get a Kli from a corporation, from a company, not from an individual, you shouldn't need to. But as far as I know, I have never seen anything in print from a postseg that you don't have to. There might be oral psakim. Rav Yashiv, for all I know, could have given such a psak. But I've never actually seen it in print. Okay, well, the conservative issued a tshuva like this, but I don't know. What can I say? I don't think any conservative Jews are being tovel and kalim anyway, so it's not such, doesn't... Not, I mean, most Orthodox Jews aren't being told Kalim either, but that doesn't change the matter that it's still halacha. The conservatives might have great arguments. Many of their tshuvas, Isaac Klein and their the Rabbinical Assembly Commission, the logic is impeccable. However, from the Orthodox standpoint, it's not just enough to have good logic. I could write a tshuva and have great logic also. There needs to be the halachic imprimatur. We need to have an authority figure give his imprimatur, or give her imprimatur. It's not enough just to have good logic. Look, there's lots of logical things. Logically, stainless steel, you should be able to use the same pots for milchik and fleishik. The whole point of stainless steel means there's no blia, there's no absorption. Unless you're going to tell me that this whole idea of absorption is a halachic concept without any reference to any reality. But I mean, there's lots of things that you can make a very good case, but until the Posig of Satcher makes the case, next week at the beginning I'll speak a little bit about Kitnios. I'll get into that a little. But just to anticipate, Korn. Korn shouldn't be Kitnios either. Korn is a new world. We'll talk a little more about this, but that doesn't mean that it's we can follow that. Well, they make it also. A company's making it, Dove. It's not an individual. So a company's making it, and a company's selling it to you. I forget if it's who makes it. If a Jew makes it and the guy then uses it, I forget if you have to do tefillah again. I'm not sure. But in any event, we're dealing with corporations. We're not dealing with individuals. I don't know. Okay, if you can find it, I'd like to know. David Galinkin has some wonderful tshuvot, which is full of interesting makorot on this. Maybe he came up with something. In general, Ritzit Pesach had a much more positive view towards the state of Israel than the Chazon Ish. And that's to be expected. He served in a government role. In fact, there's a chapter on him in this book. Atchaltahi. Yachasam Shagodoi Sfar V'Ashkenaz L'Tzionut O'Hakamat Medina. By, where's the name? Yitzhak Dadon. I've mentioned him in the past. Why is Yitzhak Dadon famous? Yitzhak Dadon was the yeshiva bacher. He's more than a bacher. He's in his 30s now. Who was at the top of the Merkaz Harad Yeshiva when the terrorists came in. And when you had a policeman, I think two policemen out front, they heard the shooting. They got this one policeman. She is directing traffic that the bus shouldn't go down. Another policeman keeping people out while the shooting's going on. It boggles their mind. It was Yitzhak Dadon, who, in addition to being a great Talmud Chacham, author of many Sfarim, this is not an independent sefer. This is really a collection of Rabbanim's works on Zionism, but he has original Sfarim. And there was another person, a graduate, I believe, of Merkaz. They took their guns, and they went in, and they finished off the terrorists. So I think it's a wonderful example, I mentioned it before, of like a King David, one who both is Torah scholar and also military warrior. But he has a chapter in here on Ritzit Pesach Frank, because Ritzit Pesach Frank said some very Zionistic things about the state. He states explicitly that the return of Jews to the land of Israel is part of the Messianic process, and that the creation of the state is Aschalta Degula, the beginning of the redemption. That expression that Rav Soloveitchik was so opposed to. We're going to have to get into, maybe in a future class, this new book that came out, The Rav Speaking Aloud, in which you really get a sense for Rav Soloveitchik's, I won't even call it Zionism, he's about as non-Zionist a Zionist as there could be. I think even some people are going to be very disappointed reading it, because he never would have written this, that's for sure, because writing, you have to be more measured in your words, but just the transcript of the way he's speaking to his class, and they keep pressing him on the significance of living in Israel and Torah Eretz Yisrael, and he's almost mocking in the way he's laughing at them. Don't give me this stuff, Torah Eretz Yisrael. There's no reason to go move to Israel. I mean, you see, I think part of it is that day he was just angry because Yom HaTzimut, they took out the Torah and the Haftarah, they're going to read a Haftarah, and he got so angry at this Zionism that he showed a very anti-Zionist side. But even in that, I mean, he says like that the person who came up with these ideas and the ceremony, the order of services for Yom HaTzimut is a mental defect. I think that's the word he uses, or he might even say retarded. I forget the word. And these were great rabbonim who did this. So, there's more I want to say about that book at a future time. But he's so opposed to the concept of Aschalta Degula, and yet Ritzit Pesach affirms it. He was also a big believer in Aliyah, even for the non-religious. Shlomo Zalman Shragai, who was the mayor of Jerusalem, a big Mizrahi person, went to Ritzit Pesach because people were saying that Mizrahi should not be involved in bringing non-religious Jews to the land of Israel. It's Metame, the land, and the like. And Ritzit Pesach said, absolutely not. We bring everyone to the land of Israel. Everyone. There was this a famous case where the Rav was in Shul, and they took out the Torah. I think they took out the Torah because it was a Monday or Thursday. They didn't actually take it out to read. What they did, they started to read a Haftarah. There are people who say that you should read a special Torah portion also, but I think it was the Haftarah that got him, because he goes off into how can you have a Haftarah? It doesn't make any sense, and it goes on for like 30, 40 pages. That book itself was controversial. There's something in a future class I want to say about the book. I'll get back to it. But I don't know what they do today in YU, but in those days, the students decided what to do with the minyan. And the Rav would say challah without a bracha if the minyan said it. But to start doing with the haftarah, what he felt was ceremonies, that was too much for him. The problem with this book, I'll just say it briefly, we only have about 10 more minutes left of Rav Tzvi Pesach, is that it contradicts so much else that we know the Rav said. For example, this David Holzer, who incidentally opened up a kosher gelatin place in America, he produces kosher, you know, non-meat gelatin, he was a shamus of the Rav for a number of years, but let's not forget, he was a young guy. He's 20, 21, 22, 23. So when he asked the Rav a question, and the Rav answers, that's going to be very different than when the Rav is asked by a colleague. So, to give you an example, when Rabbi Holzer was going to Israel to help set up this girls' school, maybe he's in his 30s or something, and he asked the Rav about having mixed singing, boys and girls, the Rav says, I don't know any heter. That's his recollection of what the Rav said. I'm assuming what the Rav said is something along those lines. But that doesn't mean that the Rav didn't... What it means is that the Rav doesn't think that you should do this in Israel in this girls' yeshiva you're establishing, because that's a different clientele. In Maimonides, the Rav certainly knew a heter, because in Maimonides, the girls sang in groups. And the Rav himself thought that things like the opera were not kolisha. And the Rav said that he accepts everything in the Sri Deish, except for the tshuva on stunning. And the most famous tshuva in the Sri Deish is this precise tshuva about mixed singing. And to this very day in Maimonides, the girls sing in groups. So, I mean, just to throw this out there as if the Rav had a different view or about birth control, where he quotes the Rav in opposition to birth control, well, Rav Aaron Lichtenstein has said something, said different things. I think it's very different when someone makes an off-the-cuff remark because a bacher asks him a shaila, and he says one thing that's not halacha Moshe Mitzrayim here. So you really need to take this book very carefully. That applies not just to what he says halachically. It applies to his hashkafa comments. The Rav could be naughty is the word. He could, you know, he can make sharp comments. He makes comments about Rav Kook. He says, I went into Rav Kook. I asked him what to do on Yom Tov Shein Shagalios, but I didn't listen to him. You know, he can make comments like that. I don't think he'd want the world necessarily to know that he didn't hold of the Rav Kook as such a great Lamdan. So it's a very problematic book in that sense. I wouldn't say, I don't know if it's revisionism. It's the Rav would say different comments. But you know what? Was it Salanter who said? You saw Salanter, not everything you think you say, not everything you say you write, and everything you write you publish. So if a young guy asks the Rav a question, he's going to respond differently when he sees a from yeshiva guy than if an older rabbi in a different community asks. These are different types of questions. If I'm not mistaken, with regard to the birth control, Rav Lichtenstein said that the Rav held it was no different than getting married. You don't have to get married at 18. You can postpone marriage for good reason, so you can postpone having children for good reason. And that was one of the issues. There's lots of issues in the book. We'll get back to the book another time. There's no time to get into the propriety of private conversation. We'll do that in a future class. Let me see. We have 3 more minutes, a couple more words. Rav Tzvi Pesach also said that there were people who thought, who had this view, that if you have a non-religious person working for you, or it's a chance, and you have a religious person who needs a job, you can fire the non-religious person and give his job to the religious person. And Rav Tzvi Pesach said, absolutely not. You can't do that. Now, he had this great connection to Eretz Yisrael from his earlier days. If you recall my talks on Rav Tzvi Hirsch Kalischer, we spoke about his Drishat Zion. Well, in 1919, Rav Tzvi Pesach published a little booklet, a kuntres, called Har Tzvi, which becomes the name of all his responsa, in which he deals with all aspects of the Beit HaMikdash, entering the Har HaBayit, the Kotel, and it appears as an appendix to an edition of Rav Tzvi Hirsch Kalischer's Drishat Zion, because Drishat Zion deals with many of these issues. Now, I see it's already coming close to 10, and I have about 10 more minutes, probably, to deal with Rav Tzvi Pesach, more about Aliyah, and some of his positions where he agreed with the Haredim, etc. We'll get to that next class, probably after about 15, 20 minutes, then we'll move on to Rav Shlomo Messas, one of the most important Sephardic rabbis of modern times. I'm sure a number of you have never heard of him, but quite interesting and important. I see it's already 10. If anyone has any questions, first let me say thank you for all who came tonight. I see some new names I don't know. If you're interested, all the previous classes are on the website, and we go in an order. So although they're not set up yet, they will be set up in a proper order so you can follow it along. Does anyone have any questions or comments? I will get back to another time the propriety of such a book. I don't think there's a problem at all. Everyone who writes about the Rav shares their recollections. Just look at any book on the Rav. It's always, I asked the Rav this, I asked the Rav that. Here we have the Rav word for word, so what could possibly be wrong with it? Not to mention the fact the Rav knew he was being taped. He taped about 100 hours. What does the Rav think he's being taped for? However, you need to bear in mind that private conversations are different, and you shouldn't give it the same weight as you do something that's written. That's all I would say. I don't see any problem with the propriety of publishing that. And if there is, then Nefesh HaRav or Rav Schechter is the same thing. Comments on Rav Cook. Well, what did he say about Rav Cook? He called him Cook. For many, we don't speak that way. But for people of the older generation, Litvisher Rabbanim, especially Litvisher Rabbanim are always cynical. They refer to rabbis by last names. This is new frumkeit that even Hirsch is not called Hirsch. He's called Rav Hirsch. But in Germany, he was always Hirsch. In the Litvisher world, they didn't have problems doing that. What he says about Rav Cook is that he wasn't the greatest Lamdan. That shouldn't surprise you. Because according to the Briskers, the only Lamdanim are real Briskers. And Rav Cook himself was opposed to the Brisker method. He wrote, I think it's Rav Neria, who has it? One of the books on Rav Cook quotes Rav Cook why he was opposed to the Brisker method. In the Volozhin Yeshiva, you had the followers of the Netziv and the followers of Chaim. The Briskers didn't hold of the Netziv's learning either. So the fact that Rav Soloveitchik doesn't hold that much of Rav Cook's learning, it shouldn't surprise you. Rav Soloveitchik says that anyone who doesn't learn in accordance with the Brisker method, you're not married to the Torah. It's not nisuin. It's only kiddushin. It's like kissing the bride through the veil. Rav Cook did not learn in accordance with the Brisker method. So obviously, he's not one of the great Lamdanim. That's all it means. Now, it's true that many people reading it might not understand this. The Rav could have said this. The Rav said about Rav Moshe Feinstein. The Rav made negative comments about Jews from Rav Moshe Feinstein. He made negative comments about lots of great Rabbanim. That doesn't mean they didn't think they were great, but that if you're not a Brisker, then the learning is not the same. So if I was doing the book, I would have had a footnote explaining these points, that it's not that he's being disrespectful to Rav Cook and calling him Cook, and it's not that he doesn't think that he's a great Talmud Chacham. What does it mean to learn? To learn means to have Brisker understanding, analysis. Do you know that the Rav, in his early years, told Rabbi Chiyak of Weinberg that his grandfather knew how to learn better than the Vilna Gaon? The Sri Yesh quotes this. So if Rav Soloveitchik could say that his grandfather could learn better than the Vilna Gaon, obviously Rav Cook is not going to impress him in terms of learning. Yeah, you feel, but there's lots of these books today, Stories of Gedolim. You feel like a bit of a voyeur, but if you've read enough letters of Gedolim, you should be able to distinguish between what's serious and what's not. If Chaim Soloveitchik wanted to write a book, he could have 10 volumes of a book. Because he sat with his father every Shabbos for lunch, and he could record what my father said about Harry Truman, and what my father said about this and that. After a while, it becomes ridiculous. Not everything the Rav ever said. You know, if he made a comment for 2 seconds about Abba Eban, that doesn't mean it's significant. He made lots of comments. Every day, every minute of the day, he was making comments about something. You know, these don't have significance. Even a Gadol, not everything he says has enduring significance. Nah, if you were ever in a shiur like that, I was in the shiur one summer, so it was at the end. But even then, when he was old, you got a little bit of a sense of this. So certainly, speak to people in the 50s and the 60s, the things he said and how he spoke. But lots of people spoke. The Sri Yesh, I told you, I have a transcript of a 60-page transcript of an interview Rabbi Chiyak of Weinberg gave, which is quite explosive. Because similar stuff to the Rav speaking about. He's judging everyone under the sun. That's how Litvisher Gedolim. That's what they were like, Litvisher Gedolim. What can I tell you? I don't know if he regarded this as criticism. To say that he doesn't think Rav Cook's a tzaddik. He's not a London. I don't know if that's a criticism in the sense that he's not saying someone's an evil or a bad person. I think anyone who ever learned by the Rav knows that he didn't hold of people. He doesn't hold of Rav Avad Yosef's learning. He doesn't hold of Rav Kook. He doesn't hold of people if they're not in that model. So I don't know. Yeah, that's true too. So it creates all these problems. I think certain of the things in the book are foolish. There's no need to put them there. This reminds me of the book Valei Lo Yibolds. I can't reach it here. It's over there. There's a book published by a guy. He used to accompany Rosh Zalman Auerbach back and forth from the Beis Medrash every day and ask him questions on every subject under the sun. And he published this book a couple years ago. And he has Haskama there, three or four Haskamas. One from Rav Nebensal, who's a big student of Rav Shlomo Zalman, one from Rav Zalman Nechemia Goldberg, and then he has a Haskama. It's the craziest Haskama in history. There's two volumes. That's great. Correct. It's a Haskama from the son of Rav Shlomo Zalman, the Rav in Tveria. And in this Haskama, if you want to call it that, he says, you should not publish this book. Just because my father told you something, al regel achas, as he's walking back and forth, that doesn't mean necessarily this is something that should be there permanently. He's saying that my father would say things, but that doesn't mean that you need to, that it's something that for permanent value. So why does he include this? Because he's an honest person. Why does he publish the book? Because he had another son of Rav Shlomo Zalman that agreed with him, and he has the son-in-law. So it's not a simple matter, and this book has interesting stuff. People who were students of Rav Shlomo Zalman told me that it's very much like Rav Shlomo Zalman, and yet it's the same sort of thing. Rav Shlomo Zalman makes comments. But let me give you an example, since you're still with me. I'll give you an example of how Rav Shlomo Zalman never probably would have written this, but from what he said, you can learn a lot. And it really proves Chaim Soloveitchik's mimeticism thesis. Anyone who's been to Shul and has paid attention, you'll see that sometimes these girls come back from Israel. I don't know what they teach them there, but they stand up when someone gets an aliyah. You know, the Baruch Hu Hashem, they stand up. Now, I've davened with great rabbanim my whole life. You never see the men do it, because the men have been in yeshiva, and the men have davened with Gedol Yisrael, and they've seen the Gedol Yisrael don't stand up. So, well, why would the men stand up? So, I don't know. Maybe in the girls' schools they tell them to stand up. It's always struck me as strange. In this book, this man, Stepansky, records a conversation. He was with Rav Shlomo Zalman. Someone comes up and asks Rav Shlomo Zalman, you know, shouldn't we really stand up? He tries to prove to him. I think he quotes the Chai Adam, but I couldn't find it. You know, because it's like a Devarim Shur Gedusha. And Rav Shlomo Zalman looks at him and says, look around. No one does this. And then the man keeps asking him, well, halacha, shouldn't we? And Rav Shlomo Zalman firmly again says, look around. That's not the minhag. I think this is a great story. You have someone trying to bring some new frumkeit on, and Rav Shlomo Zalman says, look, Rav Shlomo Zalman grew up among Gedol Yisrael, who grew up among Gedol Yisrael, no one ever did this. So what are you giving me this stuff for? Then now we should start standing up. So that, I think, really is a very interesting story. And so these books are valuable. But I don't think it's in the Ramah. Not for Aliyah. I don't believe so. But you can check on it. If you find it, send it to me. I don't think he's referring to when someone gets an aliyah that everyone stands up. It's Baruch Hu. Obviously, Baruch Hu, you stand up for Ma'ariv and in Shacharis, but not when you get an aliyah. In fact, in Sabbatka, they didn't stand. In Sabbatka, they stood up for Kriyas HaTorah. You have some people who Dafka stand up for Kriyas HaTorah. Yeshiva people sometimes stand up for Kriyas HaTorah and sit down for the brachas. But these girls from seminary, they do just the opposite. They stand up for the brachas and sit down. So I don't know. I've never had the courage. I don't want to insult them. I don't know where they get this stuff from. I've never seen any Rav ever do this. So I don't know. Okay, any other comments? I am guessing the Rav's family doesn't like the book also, because even though this was there was no one closer to the Rav's family than the Holtzers. If I could guess, what Chaim Soloveitchik would say is that it's a shabby job, that there's nothing wrong with having conversations with the Rav, but it has to be done properly and has to give the context. And this book has so many problems. In this book, at one place, he's quoting the Rav, describing his time coming to Berlin, and the Rav, he says, I'm an outlander, O-U-T-L-A-N-D-E-R. Now, there's no word outlander. No one really knows what he's talking about. What the Rav said is he was an Ausländer. That means he was an East European, or he's someone who came from outside of Germany. And there's other examples of this where the transcriber doesn't understand what the rub's talking about. And so there's all sorts of problems with the book. That's why I think, and also I think the protein, the foolish things that were included in the book. Because the Rav made a 10-second comment about Abba Ibn, that needs to be included. It makes the Rav look simplistic. I don't know. Yeah, well, the Hasidim often wear talis on the street. I think Kenneth is correct, that if all you had is the stuff, the written stuff, you forget that we're dealing with real people, and people who could make jokes, and I don't know. We'll get back to the book, and if you haven't seen the book, you get it pretty cheap. It's worth seeing. I do think it might disillusion some of you, because you thought of the Rav differently, but take my word for it. All the great rabbis, if you spoke to them personally, you'd hear comments and things like that, so... Unless there's any more questions, I told you I have the thing, but I'm afraid to publish it. The real reason I'm afraid is because he has some negative comments about Rav Aaron Cutler. Rav Aaron, they turned him into an idol, and all in good time. One day I'll publish some excerpts, because he speaks about some Hasidish Rebbe, who I don't want to say his name, because the dynasty is a little well known now, that this Rebbe, he says, literally could not understand the Mishnah, that he was a complete Am Haaretz. And he knew he was being taped. This was an interview, an official interview with a tape recorder, so one day it'll be published, but maybe not now. Yeah. Okay, I will. In any event, this has been another enjoyable evening. We'll stop here tonight. Someone sends in quickly. Meet up next class. We'll do a little bit with Rosh Pesach, and then move into a world that I hope will be eye-opening for many of you. It certainly was eye-opening for me when I first started delving into it, that of Moroccan Jewry and Rav Shalom Nesas, one of the great post-scheme of our era. Good night, everyone.